the cycling podcast live from Lionel's Lounge with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Good evening.
And we're coming at you live from, where are we, Lionel?
We're in my lounge, live from Lionel's Lounge, the cycling podcast live, our first experimental freeform jazz live podcast, 30 minutes only this evening, on air till 7 p.m.
First and last live podcast. This is a bit of a test run, a dress rehearsal. We're all appropriately dressed for our live podcast from the Olympic Velodrome on Sunday, where we are bringing you live coverage of Bradley Wiggins' attempt at the hour record. We're doing lots of podcasts this week. We've already recorded a regular show wrapping up the Giro, which will be available Tuesday, I think. There'll also be a special Hour Record preview show on Thursday morning, that's supported by Jaguar. Thank you, Jaguar, for that. And on Sunday, of course, the live podcast. It's a busy old week, isn't it? Are there any days we're not podcasting this week?
No, we're not podcasting on Wednesday, but we will be recording things. I think we're due to see Bradley Wiggins, aren't we, in the Velodrome on Wednesday ahead of Sunday's Hour Record attempt. But this half hour, we thought we'd throw it open to our listeners, all our friends of the podcast, and answer some of the questions we asked on Twitter an hour or so ago, if anyone had any questions. And
it turns out they do. They do have questions. There's lots of questions flooding in. I hope you're all listening. Because we don't really understand the technology, will people be able to listen to this after the event?
Yes, they will. We will embed this on our website, so if anyone catches up, they won't be listening now if they're missing the start, will they? But yes, they'll be able to listen again. We'll post it on our website. But at the moment, our audience is growing in front of our eyes. We're very much testing out this technology this evening, and we're well into double figures of listeners at the moment.
Fantastic. That's better than normal. Daniel, you're just back from, before we get on to the questions, you're just back from Italy. Did you have a pleasant time over in Italy? Any Giro chat for us?
I was actually at the Italian MotoGP, which I'm not really interested in, but I was there. I was supposed to go to the Giro. I was on a bit of a secret mission, didn't make it up to the Giro, but it was cycling related, the reason why it was at the MotoGP.
Well, that could be coming up in a future podcast. Who knows? Well, we get on with the questions. Well, at what point is one of us going to say, can we record that bit again and realise that that's not actually possible for once? Our producer, Paul, is sitting here beside us wearing headphones and laughing knowingly at that. So come on, Lionel, you pick a question. Okay, I will. Philip Wilson asked, do you think Froome will be any match for Contador at the Tour?
Yes, I do. Yes, I think it will be the four-way race that we're anticipating between Chris Froome, Alberto Contador, Vincenzo Nibali and Nairo Quintana. And the first week will be the usual process of elimination. Somebody will have a mare on the cobbles. Somebody's team will fall apart in the team time trial at the end of the first week. Somebody will get caught out in some crosswinds. Somebody will crash. And we'll see whether all four of them make it to the Pyrenees intact.
I was writing a story for a South African magazine today, and I compared cycling's big four to the big four in tennis. I compared each one with, I mean, who would you, I said Contador's Federer, kind of long career, consistent, classy, talent, and perhaps the most talented of his generation. Froome is Rafa Nadal. Same build, same physique. No, just because he came along and beat the champion, Contador. I'm sort of regretting this now. I said Nibali was Andy Murray because he's not flash, but a hard worker. Nairo Quintana is Djokovic, who is a prodigy who might just blow them all away. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think Froome is definitely the best on clay.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure about it, but he is actually. Actually, that ties in with another question. Somebody asked about the penultimate climb of the Giro, Daniel, Saturday stage, where you were telling me off for my pronunciation earlier, Col de Finestri.
Yeah, okay, that's close enough. Go on.
Okay, Col de Finestri. It was a gravel road. It was a steep climb, and it came before the climb up to Sestriere, which was more of a sort of motorway. It's a smooth road, quite wide. And it was on the, somebody asked, I can't find the question now, but whether Contador was sandbagging when he got dropped on that climb, or whether that climb was just so hard that that was the climb that sort of found him out. What do you think?
I think he was struggling a little bit. I think he's got one eye, obviously, on the Tour de France, doesn't want to go too deep. But he was also, as we mentioned in a previous podcast, using all of his experience, I think, throughout the Giro, and was very aware of the fact that he was very vulnerable with such a poor team, and Astana was so strong. That he knew that he could manage his advantages. His advantage was over 4 minutes. There was no real need to take any risks on the penultimate day. I think he would have loved to win that stage, but he realised quite early he didn't have the legs to do it. So I think there was a bit of sandbagging, yeah.
We've got a lot of questions to get through, but one's just come in, a live question's just come in. I'm afraid I can't pronounce his name. But the question is, who is the most boring pro you've interviewed? That's a great question. Do any of us want to answer? Who's the most boring interview of your career?
There are a lot on there. Damiano Cunego is pretty bad, I have to admit. He was on Italian TV during Giro. Pretty damn awful. Nice guy. Most of them, they're all nice guys, the boring ones. But well, they are, aren't they? I mean, that comes with the territory of being boring. But yeah, support for choice in that category, I think.
Does it come with the territory? Can you be boring and not a nice guy? There's a that widens that out from cycling, perhaps.
Maliciously boring. Yeah, I've done some interviews where it's felt like the subject has been maliciously boring. It's not his fault, but Edvald Boasenhagen is very hard work. When he's just not, he has no real interest in the history of cycling or really cycling.
Yes. Yes. That's true. Yeah. Yeah, certainly. I was going to say Edvald Boasenhagen as well. He's a nice bloke. Actually, that kind of backs up your theory there, Daniel. What's our next question? You've all moaned about race nomenclature. At the end of the day, the name chosen for a tour is a proper noun. Jonathan. I think we know him. Let's not bother with that. That was part one of two. Jonathan, you can knock number two on the head. Tinkoff. Oleg Tinkoff creates as many headlines as his riders. Is he good for cycling? Asks Phil Walton. Is Oleg Tinkoff good for cycling?
I think time will tell on that. There's still a lot of instability around his team. I think, you know, no one there has had any discussions about contract renewal for, well, certainly the riders who are out of contract. However, I understand that the situation has sort of calmed down in the last month or so. A lot of riders on that team feeling a lot more settled and stable than they were actually when Bjarne Riis was there and there was this power struggle going on between Tinkoff and Riis. So that's as far as his team is concerned at the moment. You know, some, well, a lot of other team managers, team owners roll their eyes at him, and others think that he, you know, is bringing a lot of exposure and a lot of headlines, which cycling needs.
Yeah, I think Oleg Tinkoff is very good for Oleg Tinkoff. He dyed his hair pink to celebrate Alberto Contador's victory in the Giro. I sometimes think he perhaps is taking a little bit too much credit for his team's successes and hands out a little bit too much stick when the team don't live up to his expectations. I don't see him as a particularly even-handed boss. You know, he too much of what he says in the public domain is, you know, ends up making the Tinkoff-Saxo team look less good rather than making them look better.
Mm. Dave Brailsford wouldn't have dyed his hair pink like that, would he? As somebody pointed out. Yeah, next question. Tinkoff. We probably mentioned this on the podcast before. We had Oleg Tinkoff over as guest of honour to the cycling writers' Christmas dinner. And it was a very interesting, eye-opening experience. He is clearly somebody, we spoke to him, he's clearly somebody who's very passionate about cycling, and the passion appears to be very, very genuine. But he was remarkably uninterested in what anybody else had to say or in anybody else, full stop. You know, he basically held court for an hour or so, and he was surrounded by journalists, and some of them were quite experienced, some of them had been around for quite a long time. They could have had interesting things to say, perhaps, but he didn't show any interest whatsoever in anything that anybody else said, and he just sort of held court on his thoughts on his team in particular and his obsession, I have to say, with Dave Brailsford. Next question from Joe Russell. How would you rate Brian Cookson's work so far as president of the UCI? Well, we have Brian Cookson on our forthcoming Friends special, which is looking at the doping question in particular in connection with the CERC report. And one of the questions I remember you asking him, Daniel, was along the lines of a lot of his, it's not ruling by committee so much, but there are a lot of decisions appear to be delegated to committees and so on, and there isn't perhaps the strong individual at the helm. There's not this perception of there being an individual at the helm in the way that there was under Pat McQuaid and certainly Hein Verbruggen, his predecessor. And Brian explained this to us as a positive thing, but I don't know, do you feel that there's perhaps a need, a requirement for a stronger leadership?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult balance to strike, isn't it? I feel that sometimes there is maybe a lack of accountability in the sense that everything seems to be delegated now and that everything seems to be independent, which of course is what we lobbied for, what we wanted for years and years. But sometimes it does seem to be taking it a little too far, and that's certainly what I've been hearing from riders and team managers over the last few months. Most of the complaints directed at Cookson are about a sort of lack of strength in his leadership, a lack of a figurehead really for the UCI, and a lack of a kind of firm hand steering the ship. That's certainly what is, like I say, the most common criticism that's being levelled at him at the moment.
On the positive side, I think we can. I think what we don't sort of question or doubt is Brian Cookson's commitment, determination to doing the right thing. He certainly wants to do the right thing, and I think sometimes he gets involved in small spat stories that he shouldn't actually get involved in. A couple of examples being the minor stushy, as we say in Scotland, over the outfits worn by the Colombian women's team, which caused a sort of storm on Twitter and in mainstream media as well. I think he should just have kept out of that. And the story about Lance Armstrong riding a bit of the Tour de France as part of a charity ride this year, I just didn't see any need for him to get involved in that at all. And on the subject of Lance Armstrong, a question from Kieran Doherty, and this is directed at Daniel. Did Lance cheat at golf, free boss?
No, he didn't. As far as I know, I mean, I probably wouldn't know. I'll have to consult the hidden camera footage that but no, he didn't. I probably gave him too many putts in hindsight. I was very generous. I gave him a few three footers that if I was to play him again, I wouldn't be so generous with.
No gifts. Right, next question. One for Freeboss. If gravel climbs are the next big thing, which ones should Latour use in future? Daniel being our resident climbing mountains expert.
I would have to do some research on that, but I think there is a possibility that the Tour will venture into Italy in search of that kind of climb in the future, and the Colle delle Finestre that with the Giro did in future is certainly at the weekend is certainly one that's been mentioned, and certainly one that is handily placed in terms of logistics. I mean, you could easily have a finish going over the Finestre and finishing at Sestriere as the Giro stage did at the weekend in the Tour de France.
A quick update. Earlier, I struggled with the Gaelic spelling of our questioner's name. It's Kevin in Gaelic. Sorry about that, Kevin. I'll know in future. Next question. Have you picked out a question there, Lionel? There's so many.
Well, Tim Frost asks, it's a bit late to the party, but have we had a is Richie Porte finished as a Grand Tour contender question yet?
No.
We haven't had the question, or we're answering the question?
We haven't had the question.
Well, is Richie Porte finished as a Grand Tour contender, Richard?
No.
Excellent, excellent. Next one. What's gone wrong at Garmin this year? They're having a mare, says Alex Bevan.
Cannondale Garmin.
We've addressed this to a certain extent in previous pods. They haven't got a roster with many sort of bankers. I think, you know, you look at any team that doesn't have a sprinter, prolific sprinter, or perhaps a time trialist who's likely to win races, is in danger of having long barren spells in the season. And if you looked at Garmin Cannondale's roster at the start of the season, you would have said that that was a team that could easily get to April, May without having won many races, and that's what's happened. I actually think that they've redeemed the first half of their season with a really excellent Giro d'Italia, with a team with some experience, certainly with Tom Danielson and Ryder Hagedale, but not a team that's fancied to do very well. But they won a fantastic stage with Davide Formolo, and Hagedale rode a fantastic Giro. So I think, given the budget they've got, given the riders they've got, I don't think they're doing too badly.
Here's a question from Ollie Wright. This quick fire question: where do you think the free agents will end up next year? Uran, Port, Landa, Zakarin. Uran, Daniel.
Uran, I think, is likely to stay at Etics, but it's a tricky one because they have not got a huge amount of money, not as much money as people would imagine. Certainly not that much money left over when they've paid everyone else. And Landa is a name that has been mentioned in connection with Etics Quickstep. So, you know, it could be that Patrick Lefebvre, if he's talking to Landa's agent, might be weighing up the pros and cons of Uran against Landa, and it might be that Landa takes his place at Etics next year. And Port will stay at Sky, I'm fairly sure. And Zakarin, I have no real lead on that. I would suggest he'll probably stay at Katusha.
And Landa, we think Mikel Landa might be Skybound as well, perhaps. No?
I just said Etics is what I've heard, but Sky...
I wasn't listening. I was looking for other questions. Sky were certainly interested in him a couple of years ago when Euskaltel disbanded and they picked up Mikel Nievi, who I thought was a little bit disappointing at the Giro. Question from Colin Barnes. Astana scare me. I don't think it's the colours. Too much like US Postal and too many rumours, thinking the Greg Henderson tweet. Honestly, guys, what are your feelings? Well, we spoke about this quite a bit in our regular podcast, which will be going out on Tuesday, but no reason why we can't address it briefly again. We did talk a little bit about not being that sure as to the overall standard of the top 10 in the Giro. You know, we saw the same characters at the front every day. Contador clearly was a very good and strong winner, but really, was that a top 10 of top caliber riders apart from Contador? It's hard to tell, and that, of course, could put a bit of a false gloss on the Astana performance. We certainly, you can't be unaware of all the chatter on Twitter and so on. But to some extent, you know, we had this in 2012 with Team Sky, we had it in 2013 with Team Sky. It comes with the territory that a team that's going well, that's performing outstandingly well, and seems to have numbers up there, will attract suspicion. And I think particularly Astana, given the stories that have dominated or prevailed around them all year leading up to the tour, it fits a narrative, doesn't it, that Astana are the dirty team, are the evil team. And to see them performing so well does, for a lot of people, raise eyebrows. I think we tried in our discussion earlier to step back from that a little bit and actually look at it in a sort of more rational way. And I'm not aware of anything to suggest that there's anything suspicious about the performance. They're good riders. As Daniel's made the point in previous podcasts, they are all good riders on earning a lot of money.
Yeah, I think that. Difficulty is that you can look at absolutely any factor in a bike race and lead it back to the question of whether or not a rider is doping. If somebody comes out of nowhere, they're assumed to be doping. If somebody is consistent and is always in the first few places, they're assumed to be doping. If somebody has a good, you know, run of good days, is that doping? If somebody has one bad day amongst four good days, is that doping? If two riders from the same team do well on the same day, is that doping? If different riders from the same team do well on consecutive days, is that doping? And so on. And I think that we need to sort of take a step back.
The only way to avoid that is to always be rubbish.
Well, there is that, yeah. If you're always rubbish, then, you know, you don't get the suspicion coming your direction. But there aren't the same questions about, you know, Stefan Kruijswijk. There aren't the same questions about Ryder Hesdal, who've had very strong final weeks in the Giro. So it is because of the history. It's because of the man who runs the Astana team, Alexander Vinokourov, who has served a doping ban, of course. It's because they're fairly opaque when it comes to talking about doping themselves. Daniel?
A few points. It was the Giro turned into a real head-to-head battle between Tinkov and Astana. Now, Tinkov have had real problems this year with the training with some of their riders. There've been a lot of complaints from riders in their team. They've been working too hard, and they've had to really reassess how they're training, you know, how they're coaching some of the riders. And I'm led to believe that's been remedied now. However, there may well be a legacy of this very, very difficult training that Tinkov did early in the season. They went to altitude extremely early. Aru has spent a lot of time at altitude but didn't go until February. I think Tinkov were already there in Mount Etna in January. So that's one issue. Also, I think Tinkov picked the kind of team that you would usually pick for a Tour de France. A lot of guys who are good on the flat, and a lot of very, very experienced guys, and rather than pack their teams with mountain climbers, and it didn't really work. So, you know, there are further reasons which might, to a certain extent, explain Astana's superiority over Tinkov.
Tinkov were altitude training up Kilimanjaro back in November or something. They did a trek up Kilimanjaro. Question from John Ady. After seeing testing at the Giro, do you think it's realistic that teams could be using motors and bikes? Daniel or Lionel?
The consensus about this among riders is that it is impossible, or it hasn't happened. However, the approach the UCI are taking to this issue suggests to me they really believe that it has happened or is still happening. And, you know, L'Equipe today have published more or alluded once again to rumours about Alberto Contador and his bike, not just in the Giro, but in previous races. And it just doesn't seem to go away, this particularly with regard to Contador. I've heard a lot. But more than finding out whether people have been using motors, I'd be very keen to know what information the UCI are getting and why they are so intensely pursuing this issue.
Yeah, I mean, there have been rumours since 2010, haven't there, where it really surfaced during the Classics when people were suspicious that Fabian Cancellara might have had a motor in his bike. Earlier today, in fact, I watched on YouTube a package done by a Belgian TV station, VRT, in which Johan Museo and a 48-year-old amateur cyclist from Belgium basically had a race up the Alder Quellemont in Belgium, one of the longer cobbled climbs. First time up, the amateur cyclist went on a regular bike and was left behind by Museo. Second time up, the amateur cyclist had the motorised assisted bike, and he dropped Museo for dead. And then this amateur cyclist also used it in a kind of amateur kermesse race, just a circuit race. And, you know, the conclusion is that the technology obviously exists. The fact that UCI are carrying out the test says something, but I think the unfortunate thing is every day they publicise the fact that they've tested so-and-so's bike, so-and-so's bike. You know, it points a finger at those riders. Obviously, if they kept it quiet and carried out this testing without telling anybody, then they'd be accused of trying to cover it all up. So they're really in a no-win situation. And it is up to the UCI to police this. It's up to them to find something. And really, until a bike is found, then we're going to be asking the same question over and over again. And those who believe that the motorised bikes are being used aren't going to be satisfied by the fact they haven't been found. They're going to be thinking, well, they're just hiding it, you know, flawlessly.
Yeah, I mean, the question, I suppose, is not whether the motors help, but whether they're being used. In this video, was it secreted enough that you genuinely, it was invisible to the naked eye?
From the external look at the bike, yeah, but you'd need to take it apart a bit, and they, you know, it's clear how it works.
I witnessed the UCI bike test at the end of a stage of the Tour de France last year, the one that Michael Rogers won in the Pyrenees. Was that in Luchon? Perhaps it was in Luchon, and I started taking a picture on my iPhone, and I was told not to take a picture. But from what I could tell, they took the saddle out, they held the bike upside down, and gave it a bit of a shake. And I don't know if it's much more sophisticated than that. I saw somebody suggesting that maybe infrared or something could be used. I don't know. I mean, you know, it's surely a good thing that they are testing, because that will surely act as a deterrent. I mean, it's being treated in as an equivalent to a doping offence, isn't it? So that the punishments would be similar if you were caught. So the risks, therefore, are huge. And it can't, if you're doing that, there must, you know, and the bikes are being tested, there must be a huge risk that you're taking. And we've talked about this a bit before, and Daniel, you had an interesting theory on a rider's pride, that with doping you could rationalize it, it's still your physiology, it's still the effort is still being made by the athlete, whereas a motor and a bike just destroys that. And no athlete could rationalize that. No athlete could convince himself that he's not cheating, as I think athletes can do sometimes with doping. Don't nod, Daniel. That's not going to work. What have you? Do you want me to ask another question? All right, everybody. Daniel just nodded. To that, Oliver Jones asks, at your Tunbridge Wells event, yes, we did an event at Tunbridge Wells at the end of last year, I asked for which riders was 2015 a make or break year. Has anyone passed or failed so far? Can't remember. Who did we say?
Sagan, did we say? It's early, isn't it? It's too early to say. I mean, anyone can, a one day rider who's failed in the classics can still save their season with, for instance, the World Championships. But, to an extent, Richie Port has failed. The first test.
Well, he's not really, though.
Well, the first. No, that's true, actually, with all the smaller races that he's won. But I think it is too early to really pass any kind of definitive judgment on anyone.
Like that, all the small races. You know, you haven't been speaking to Mark Cavendish lately, have you? I think I mentioned, I don't know if I did mention, but I'll just a quick mention for Joe Dombrowski, who moved after two disappointing years from Team Sky to Cannondale Garmin. And he's been riding decently, rode well at Tour of California. I watched the US Pro Championships as well, and he had some bad luck there, but rode pretty well. And it's good to see him. I think he's a great talent. It's good to see him starting to maybe fulfill that potential. Another question, Lionel, did you have one there?
Well, yeah, which is the most hipster Grand Tour, Giro or Vuelta? It can't be the Tour de France, right? Says friend of the podcast, Luke McLaughlin. I actually think that the Tour is now so uncool that it's become cool again. So the Tour de France is now officially the hipster's Tour de France of choice. Daniel?
What would be the most hipster non-Grand Tour race, Daniel, as a resident hipster?
I consider the Tour of Portugal to be a Grand Tour and the hipster's Grand Tour, because it used to be 20-something stages long. It used to, up until a few years ago, it was still, I think, well, actually, even now, it's the longest race on the UCI calendar outside of the Grand Tours.
I think that the Amsterdam Derny race should be revived. I think it bit the dust in around 2002. It was kind of an invitation race held in the late spring, so May time. It was basically a road race with the riders paced by motorcycles, the Derny motorcycles, similar to the ones you see in the Keirin on the track. I think Michael Bogard of Rabobank won the last event. I think that would make fantastic television, but unfortunately the race no longer exists.
I think we're nearing the end of our half hour, aren't we? So we'll have to knock it on the head soon. We might do this during our record broadcast, might take questions as we go. Who knows? If we get bored, we can take questions about the...
Are we not going to have our hands full working out whether Bradley Wiggins is up or down on Alex Dowsett's record?
That's actually your job, Lionel. You've been we figured it's best just have one person concentrating on distance covered while Daniel and I provide a bit of colour and atmosphere and stuff like that, and generally try and enjoy ourselves.
You're setting me up to fail here, aren't you?
Got a really good question here from Carl Dolan. Carl asks, what role could the panel see for Sepp Blatter on cycling if he left FIFA? Maybe honorary president of the UCI, that might become vacant soon.
I could see him riding one of those Dernies that Lionel just talked about, no?
Yeah, I mean, podium boy, maybe.
He could do the Eno job, couldn't he? Or be a bus driver. I mean,
he looks a bit like there's a French photographer called Bruno Bard who has been working for L'Equipe for years and years and years. He looks very like Sepp Blatter, actually.
Well, there you go. Should we finish here? Nodding vigorously. So we'll wrap it up there. This is our first ever live podcast. It's been fun, I think. And we've just got a lol from somebody, so I think that's a vote of confidence. Lol. thanks, Lol, back to you. We'll probably do this again. We might do this at the tour if we can find, if they have the internet in France now, which I think they do, and we'll be able to find good Wi-Fi in places, and we'll do it there. But thank you very much for tuning in. Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.